Welcome to the HIV Hour. The HIV Hour is every first and Thursday at 7 p.m. It's repeated throughout the month. Check out the Radio Reverb schedule on the website, and that's radioreverb.com. Our social pages are on Twitter and Instagram, and that's at HIV_hour. And you can join our Facebook page, which is at HIV Hour Reverb. If you want to contact us, feel free on hivhour@gmail.com. Also, you can listen to and subscribe to our famous podcast. Just type in HIV Hour at Spotify, Deezer and iTunes. If you want to listen to a previous show, then you can go to our website and tune to the Listen Again page. So HIV Hour, positively helping to change hearts and minds. Good evening, David.
Good evening, George. I love to see you again.
And it's good to
welcome,
see you.
Audience.
Yes, sorry, I'm a bit rusty with the studio for some reason.
Well, we haven't been back into the studio since COVID, have we?
And there's only two of us here today, isn't there?
There is.
Everyone's abandoned us.
Quiet with everybody else, especially Sue. I mean, I miss her booming voice. And she's having a well-deserved holiday. Yeah, she's sunning herself on a beach somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
So, happy holidays, Sue.
She deserves a good holiday, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does work very hard.
Yes. I can't remember what she looks like, but she deserves it.
Her voice sticks. Yeah.
Yes. What have you been up to this week since we've been last on air?
Oh, this week? My youngest pussy, Astrid, she's pregnant with kittens. I mean, we wanted to have her to have kittens, and then we changed our minds. So we went to centre for a pre-op to get spayed, and they said, oh, she's already pregnant. We'd only let her out for 2 days. It didn't take long at all. I mean,
where'd you get that from?
I mean, well, it serves her right for being so pretty. But she's having kittens, and we're expecting them sort of in about 2 weeks' time, or sort of end of March, middle of April.
Oh, that's cool.
We've been putting boxes around the house in different rooms, sort of with little towels and little bowls of water and food nearby, in the hope that she'll choose one for her birthing bed where she'll.
She wants the nest, doesn't
she? So she's checking places out, like under the stairs and in little quiet rooms. We've been very quiet and cautious not to lift her, but she's starting to show. She's getting very voluptuous at the moment. Yeah, so I keep looking at her tummy to see if the kittens are going to move inside. But I don't know how many we're going to get. But I haven't seen any movement yet. But it must be strange having all those little legs inside of you. Kicking away. Yeah.
and having
you know, several heartbeats inside your body, that must be really weird.
Yeah, I kind of got through it, but it's okay.
Okay,
got a tablet for it.
How big was your letter?
Six.
Right. Need a lot of nipples for that.
Yeah. Well, I'm all right. What have I been doing? I've just been pottering around. Next week is the, I know I've said on the show before that the Sussex Beacon are doing a drag for a day workshop.
Oh, yes.
So we start that next week. Mm. And I got the newsletter through with all what we have to do. In the newsletter, I forgot that they wanted your sizes. And I was like, oh, you want dress size, bust size, chest size, in and leg?
Oh, right.
And I was
thinking,
how do you do? I'm trying to, I've got this, no, you're in a proper...
Things you've never measured before.
No, it's like a, what do you call it?
Yeah.
An industrial tape measure.
So like a builder's one.
Yes, yeah, so I don't know how big I'm going to be.
Careful, metal. You know, I don't want to chafe anything, do you?
No. I didn't know where to put the measure. So anyway, hopefully I've sorted
chest,
it.
Is chest, so nipples?
I think so.
Or was that bust?
I don't know. We'll have to ask Tamsin.
We'll ask our guest later on. Yes.
Who's in shortly? No, Tamsin says.
Yeah, so quietly giggling in the corner, we have a wonderful guest, Dr. Tamsin Cumming, who's a colorectal surgeon, and we'll be interviewing her and asking about her role in the CPAC study, which both you and I took part in and were volunteers for.
Yes.
We also have another great interview that Stephen did with his friend Babs. And it's lovely to hear a straight woman living with HIV talk about her story and you know, going from sort of dark times to times of hope and what have you.
And it's amazing to listen to these stories.
Yeah.
And it's heartfelt as well. So,
some
good stuff on today. Actually.
I learned so much from learning about other people's life journeys and I always, you know, no matter how bad I think my situation is, and I'm always it's an honour to hear some people, you know, talk about their stories and how the challenges they've overcome and how they don't know, live life positively.
Yeah.
Living with HIV is it's inspiring.
And it helps. It helps
yes.
in your own case, doesn't it, to do that.
And you're listening to the HIV Hour on Radio Reverb. That's 97.2 FM in the Brighton area and on DAB Plus Radio. Don't forget, you can always listen to our podcast and listen again at the radioreverb.com website. We're really pleased to have in the studio Dr. Tamsin Cumming, who Josh and I met recently in London. Tamsin is works at the Homerton Hospital and is working on the CPAC study. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Tamsin, how are you?
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, no, thanks for coming on. Yeah, thank you. It's great to have you.
Yeah, yeah. And viewers, last time we saw Tamsin, I mean, you were all robed up with your surgical mask and hood and things like that. We were both in a chair in stirrups.
Yeah, I was going to say, how deep should we go with this?
No.
That's what you said, I think, wasn't it, Tamsin?
Oops.
So, Tamsin, it's lovely to have you here. Can you just tell us what the CPAC study is?
So what it stands for is Screening for the Prevention of Anal Cancer.
Mm.
And I think that the most important thing about it is that people living with HIV, particularly gay men living with HIV, are at nearly 50 times the risk of anal cancer
really?
Than the general population.
Mm, mm.
So it's a very rare cancer in the general population.
Oh, really?
But if you're living with HIV and you're a gay man over 40, you've actually got a higher risk of anal cancer than bowel cancer. And we've got a screening program for bowel cancer, but there's no screening program for anal cancer at the moment.
Really? Wow. So you're still recruiting the study. So
we're still recruiting to the study.
And I believe you want to actually sort of have 1,000 people take part in this study.
We do.
Yeah. How many people have you recruited so far?
We're almost halfway. We're about about 500. We've got five or six sites, but they're all in London. So.
Yeah.
Very welcome for anyone listening to take part who fits the criteria. But you'd have to come up to London.
Yeah. So, I mean, Josh and I did. I mean, we've spoken on the show, haven't we, about the benefits and, you know, of taking part in research.
I think, for me personally, I don't know about you, David, but for me it was just to keep a check on my health, my sexual health.
Yeah.
And it's always a worry, isn't it, Tamsin, for that? And just, especially with being HIV as well, we just don't know how our health's going to progress as we get older, so it's good to get these studies done, isn't it?
No, it's really important. I think. I don't know, but what do you? I mean, how important do you think research is in?
Well, the community has had this great tradition of both participating in research, but also changing the agenda of the research around HIV. And I think this is also important around anal cancer as well. So it's a rather neglected area.
Mm.
But clearly it's, I mean, a lot of you, because it's so prevalent in older people living with HIV, a lot of you will know someone who's had anal cancer. So it's not just a one-off.
Mm.
And it can be really devastating disease. You know, the treatment, if you've got quite a big, if you're not screened for it, if you walk in with it, it can be like a 5-centimetre tumour and you have to have radiotherapy for it.
Mm.
And it can, you know, can just be horrible, can really affect your quality of life, can affect your sex life.
Mm.
So, you know, this is a preventable disease, a bit like cervical cancer. You know, women have got a screening program
cancer. Do you think how important is it for the screening and how easy will it be to get it? It's just from the government. Is it through the government you get?
Well, we're going to need funding for it,
yeah.
But there was a big study in the States. I probably mentioned to you two when you were up
lying down.
When you were lying down, yeah, with your legs in the air. But there was a big study that's recently completed in the States that's going to make it that's going to sort of scientifically has pushed the agenda towards screening because it's now been proven that by treating the precancerous stage AIN, you can prevent anal cancer, at least massively reduce the risk of anal cancer.
Right. So what is the difference between AIN and anal cancer?
So all of this is caused by the HPV virus, so the wart virus.
That's the human papilloma?
Human papilloma virus. One time, yeah, David. Yeah.
I wouldn't say that.
I just think of butterflies as just papilloma, like papillon. But anyway, carry on.
Yes, not quite as nice as a butterfly.
No.
But, you know, as you'll know, you can get free vaccination if you're under 45 and you identify as a man who has sex with men in sexual health clinics for HPV. But really what's going to help is the fact that we're now vaccinating boys as well as girls at school age. So that eventually is going to get rid of this disease as well as cervical cancer, but not till about 2050.
Right, yeah.
So between now and then,
all
of us pretty much have met the HPV virus, and it leads to these precancerous changes, AIN, in the women, in the cervix, CIN. But in everyone, men and women, we've all got an anus.
Yeah.
So it can produce precancerous changes there. If you catch it at that stage, you can prevent it going on to cancer.
Right, wow, wow, wow. And you took blood from us as well, and you took some biopsies, didn't you? I was fascinated because you said HPV lives on the skin. And I never thought about where the skin ends and where my inside starts. And you were going just on that boundary, weren't you? Just where the fresh skin was. It hadn't been exposed to other things, but it was nice and dark and...
Exactly.
Anyway, we're all tensing up in the studio.
In fact, we're talking to a corner there.
The listeners are tensing up. The thing is, the skin goes round the corner, and just as you say, at that bit on the inside where it changes between skin and bowel, that's where it's most susceptible to turning to cancer.
Right.
And you can only find it by having a look. Mm. The study part of the CPAC is the swab that I did at the beginning, and that's to see if there's some way we can, you know, as you were saying, with the sort of self-vending sexual health screen, it would be great if there was a swab in there that you put inside the anus, sent it off, and it would say, oh, you're the person who needs to come and get properly screened because you might have one of these anal cancer precursors. So that's what we'd like to aim for. We don't have that at the moment. But actually, if you participate in the CPAC study, as you two both have, you actually get a screening. So you get the full screening examination. And the blood test was just to see, you know, to help us in trying to judge who is the people... You know, we don't want to have to screen everybody. We want to do like a small, simple swab that will pick out the people who are most at risk. Yeah. That's the ideal screening test.
Probable that you could detect something in the blood that might suggest there's something going on inside, perhaps.
That's the sort of study part of it. They're hoping. It would be great if you just have a blood test and they'll say, oh, you're the 1 in 100 people who should come and have this.
Keep an eye on you.
But we haven't got it yet, so that's the study part.
That's the whole part of it. Yeah. But it's quite exciting, isn't it, to, you know, if you can find something to screen for disease.
It was interesting when seeing the pictures, though, because that's because you said you can see the pictures, and you went, you're trying to work out what? I was like, what is that? It was quite interesting, the whole thing, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Well, if you come up, you get the photos taken, and then afterwards I give you the anal tour insides, and you get to see it
all. Slideshow,
Have you, what's been the most, has there been some surprising things that's happened with the study then yet, or is it too early to say anything that surprised you?
Like preliminary findings, perhaps? Or
I think it's early. Too early to say. Early, I mean, the bit I'm doing is that I'm basically screening you. So that's what I normally do in my clinic.
Yeah.
So I'm doing the swab. I'm examining with the finger and then I'm looking with a scope. And it's not like a full colonoscopy where it looks like a metre and a half up your bowel. I'm literally looking 2 inches up. But I spent about 15 minutes in there, if you remember, poking around.
I do remember.
Looking very carefully with magnification at all the little folds there. Because I'm looking for very early disease, so I'm looking with a microscope, basically. And for most people, when I find it, I'm finding it early. But there has been one person where I found a cancer that they didn't know they had.
Right. Which is it's not good, but it's good because you can.
It's great because we picked it up early.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So how can people get on the study then? Because it's still open, isn't it? So.
It is still open. It's free, like all research is. So there's an email address which we'll put on the website.
Yes, we can say it now. It's CNWL. That stands for Central and Northwest London. So CNWL.CPAC, that's SEPAC, at NHS.net. CNWL.CPAC@NHS.net. For people that wanted to take part, I mean, you're given a full explanation leaflet, what the study's all about, what the procedures are. I was very much reassured when I read it all through. It guided through us very well. There's a little bit of a questionnaire as well before we actually go through the physical examination. And I would recommend it to anybody that thinks they may be at risk or, you know, fit into the eligible criteria. And what are the criteria?
So I don't want to expose you guys, but you have to be over 40. So.
Oh, I've lied about my age.
You've been lying about your age.
I've been lying about my age for years.
You have to identify as a gay man and be living with HIV. So those are the main criteria. If you've already had and survived anal cancer, then you can't be part of the CPAC
right,
study.
Right.
So that's the only other major exclusion.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you actually before that. How do you know you want to get government screening? How do we go about that then? Do we have to do campaigns or?
I think we're going to need campaigns because obviously there's lots of sort of competing people for the same pot of money, what feels like a dwindling pot of money at the moment for the NHS.
Yeah.
But like most preventative stuff, if we can get the numbers right, if we can get this screening test, if you can catch something early and prevent it, it will be cheaper for the NHS than letting someone, you know, develop extensive disease and need lots of expensive treatment. So it's better for people and it's better for the people who are, you know, counting the money to catch this kind of thing early.
Yeah.
So that's the argument we'll put. What we need is the result of this study. And then we also need to know what's the best treatment. So there's more work going on, again, worldwide, about if we do find the AIN, how do we treat it, get rid of it to prevent cancer, you know, causing you, if you have it, the minimum risk.
Yeah.
If caught early, it's perfectly survivable.
If caught early as a cancer, it's perfectly survivable. And if it's caught before the cancer stage, there's increasing evidence that it's preventable.
Which is great stuff, isn't it?
But it is. I mean, I've known that, you know, living with HIV, I'm more likely to develop certain cancers or the probability of developing certain cancers. But you said 50 times more likely as a gay man living with HIV.
Yeah.
In fact, I just recently stopped smoking as well, partly because what I've read in the literature about the study is, you know, it just ups your risk even more, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I know of people who've got ovarian cancer, and it's really not nice.
Mm.
I think when it's been left, and not nice. Do people? I think you mentioned when we came up actually that people don't go to the doctors, do they? Because they get said, it might be polyps or piles.
Yeah.
So it's just difficult to get diagnosed early.
So if you get any bits of blood in your poo.
Do you remember that campaign that was like, don't sit on your symptoms campaign? But this also, I think that this is very important, this sort of information that you're giving out here, because even doctors don't really know about anal cancer. That's how kind of taboo it is. No one likes talking about their anus, whoever they are. And so even doctors don't like talking about it. And so what happens is people who, unbeknownst to them, are quite high risk of anal cancer, are going to see their GPs, and often their GPs are saying, oh, it's just piles. You know, nowadays they might not even see the GP. They can have a conversation on the phone, and then they're going to say, oh, go down the pharmacy and get some, you know, something for piles.
Cream,
so then they get put off for months and months.
And that's a really, you know, months is a very long time. And
it can be a very long time.
When isn't it?
If you've got as far as developing an anal cancer, you know, you don't want to wait 6 months before that's diagnosed.
Well, thank you for coming on. You used to live in Brighton, didn't you? Because we're coming to the end of the interview. So
I did. It was a joy to come down and walk around Brighton again. But it was the 1990s when I was here.
Right. So that was just before treatment sort of became sort of effective, didn't it? Sort of cusp of 95, wasn't it?
Mm.
So, I mean, you were working in medicine at the time, were you?
Yeah, I was working in surgery at the time. So we didn't, although we knew about the sort of HIV ward there was at the Royal Sussex County, we didn't get involved a lot. But what was interesting was that the group of doctors and surgeons that I was working with, there was one question that was asked at one of our meetings once. Would anyone, if they had a needle stick injury, get HIV tested? And there was a show of hands, and very few people put their hands up.
Really?
Such
this
is
amongst
the
surgeons?
Level of fear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amongst surgeons in that room, there must have been about 40 people in the room. And people saying, well, it's just the end of your career, isn't it?
Yeah. Right, yeah.
But slightly worrying,
yes.
I think.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, it's because obviously they could. Not knowing your status is really dangerous.
Really dangerous.
It is. And
still
understand
is.
Understand people's fears. It is. It is. Yeah, I mean, we know now, and that stigma to back then. I mean, you know, before treatment, obviously, we know that there's an awful lot more stigma because it was treated as a disease that meant certain death, didn't it?
Yeah.
But no, thankfully, we're living in a much more informed age. We know that with U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. Listeners, I'm sure you all know that, and tell your friends all the time. We can't pass it on, and HIV isn't scary anymore. Yeah. I know one of the organisations that works in Brighton is the Martin Fisher Foundation that works against stigma. Because Brighton Hospital is part of a teaching hospital, they're teaching all new doctors how to about HIV. And
now, even if you get a needle stick injury, you actually don't need to take the preventative ARVs if it's from someone who's undetectable.
Oh, wow. No, exactly. Yes, yeah, yeah.
So sorry, we're just coming to the end of the show, the interview. Sorry. So you've picked a really good track. So good to you come down and come on the show, because it's really good to get this information out, isn't it? And you've picked a track for us, haven't you? What can you tell the listeners what it is and why you chose it?
Well, I picked a track by Bicep, who are an electronic band, and I saw them at the Green Man Festival, fantastic live show last summer with my kids, who introduced me to them. So I tried to stay young by listening to all this stuff.
I've listened to them, yeah. I've never heard them before. They're really good, actually. So this is Water and Bicep. But thank you so much for coming on, Tamsin. It's really good. And maybe come back when the results are in or something.
I'd love to. Great. Thanks very much for having me.
Don't forget, viewers, listeners, to take part if you can.
Yeah, thank you.
Radio Reverb.
Amazing track, wasn't it?
I was enjoying that, yes.
It was really good. We'll have to
look them up on my favourite music platform.
Which one? Oh, you can't say it. Yeah, that was a great interview, wasn't it? It's just so good to get this information out, and I know for me it's just good to know.
Oh, the importance of research. Happening. Yeah, yeah, and looking for how to prevent disease is so much better than curing it, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. So thanks, Tamsin, for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
So next is Stephen's not been in the studio for a while, but he's been doing interviews, and he's done a really good interview with a lady called Bab Evans, who's just talks about her HIV journey. And she's a member of, this is how Stephen knows her, he mentions this in the interview, she's a member of the London HIV choir Joyful Noise. So that's so shall we have a quick shall we have a listen?
Yes, please.
Fabulous.
HIVR is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to the HIV Hour. So today I am joined by a guest, and this is a lady that I know from singing together in Joyful Noise Choir, which is an HIV positive choir, and welcome to the show, Babs Evans.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome, Babs. So, Babs, we are waiting with bated breath to hear your story. Could you tell us a bit about your HIV story, your journey with HIV?
Yeah, so my HIV story started in 1994, and I was reading an article in a magazine about blood shortages in the UK. And I used to be a blood donor years before, so I thought, oh, I should start, go and do that again.
Yeah.
So off I went, and I gave my blood and didn't think anything more about it. And then about a week or so later, I got a letter saying that there'd been something unusual about my blood donation. I thought that was weird wording, and it didn't refer me to my GP or anything like that. It said make an appointment to go back to the blood centre. So I talked to a very close friend of mine, and we went through all the different things it could be. Mm-hmm. But actually, at the end of that conversation, I knew I was going to ask when I walked in the door, have I got AIDS, as
right.
It was then.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And I was really prepared for that and prepared to go in and ask the question. Of course, what I wasn't really prepared for was the answer that was yes. And it was just such a strange process because, you ask the kind of things like, how could I have got this? When could I have got this and everything? And actually, it was a bit of a light bulb moment because I'd worked out that years before, I'd been back and forward to the doctor for about 6 years, actually, with various different things. I'd lost about a stone and a half weight in 6 weeks and was referred to gastroenterology. All these, I had constant infections, ear infections, thrush, things like this. But nobody had ever spoken to me about, you know, getting tested for AIDS or anything like that. And when I talked to the doctor at the Blood Donor Centre, she told me about a thing called a seroconversion illness that some people with HIV get. And then I realised that actually 6 years prior to that, I had had what I now know was that seroconversion illness. I'd been very, very ill. And I'd gone to the doctor and the doctor had said, oh, it's probably just some virus you've picked up. You know, come back in a week or so if it hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
And I did get better and I never thought anything about it.
I suppose it was a different time. As you say, it was called AIDS, wasn't it? People weren't talking about HIV really so much then. It was this dreaded disease called AIDS. And I suppose, Babs, you fell into a category that wasn't looked on to be expected to be, to have HIV, to get this disease, you know, because I suppose in 1994, they were still looking at it really as sex workers and the gay disease and all that kind of thing, wasn't it?
Exactly. And the frustrating thing, though, Stephen, is that all these years later, 30 years later, there are still women like me, women, white women, Asian women, that don't fit into what is perceived as the high risk categories.
Yep.
And they get diagnosed. They still get diagnosed really, really late.
Yep.
And sometimes they die because they've not been diagnosed. And sometimes they get very, very sick and their body has already been affected by HIV to an extent that then it's affecting their future lives. Which it doesn't need to, because now we've got effective treatment. So that's what's very frustrating about my story and thinking about it in those days 30 years ago and what happens now.
Yeah, I do. I've heard it so many times, the same thing as you're saying, you know, just that there's so many women that could have been diagnosed so much sooner, you know, but because they don't fit into that stereotype, that box, you know... So how did you say life continued after HIV, Babs? Because it's a big thing for all of us. So, you know, where did the road lead you from HIV, you know?
So I think in the beginning, obviously I asked that question that people ask, how long have I got?
Mm-hmm.
And I was told 2 years. And I was thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, that's such a short amount of time. And so very, very stunned by that. And the only information I was given was an article written by a gay man who was living with HIV that I thought, well, what's that got to do with me? And very little information about where I could go for support or anything. And it's before internet and things like this. But I managed to find out about an organisation called Positively Women.
Mm-hmm.
And... that was promoted to me as an organisation run by and for women living with HIV. And I have to say that was the most fantastic experience that I had, to meet other people with HIV, especially other women with HIV. And they were such positive and strong role models for me of how you could live with this, that I didn't want to sit at home and wait to die.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact... that I was working in the charitable sector at the time, and I saw a social worker. And at that point, pre-treatment, the only thing people could do was get you on as much money as possible, the disability benefits, DLA and everything.
Yeah.
And the social worker filled in these forms for me. I didn't even see the forms that she filled in. And then said, oh, you're probably better giving up work, you know, to reduce stress in your life. And I thought, well, what would I do? I've got a massive mortgage. I lived on my own, so I was solely responsible for that mortgage.
Yep.
It was at the time when certainly insurance companies weren't paying out anything to do with if you died of HIV.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, am I going to sit at home and wait to die? I don't think so. So the fact that I'd been working for a charity and I was working with people with lots of different disabilities and illnesses, like MS, people with kidney disease, people on dialysis, stuff like that. And so they were, many of them were living with end-of-life
conditions
or life-limiting, I should say, conditions. Mm-hmm. And they were also great role models for me.
Yeah.
But it was also quite upsetting at the time because I was a support worker and I was trying to get them support and help, and there was very little out there for their different conditions. But as someone living with HIV, I could have gone to a support group every day of the week in London.
Yeah.
You know, there was so much. And there was even a support group in Harlesden, where I was living at the time, opposite the pub that I drank in. There's no way I would have gone to that support group, because at the time, I didn't tell anybody. My close friend that I'd spoken to before I went to the blood centre knew.
Mm-hmm.
And my partner knew, and he had to go and have a test and then go back after 3 months. And that was very difficult for him.
Yeah.
You know, when we split up for a while and we got back together, we split up again. You know, it was a really difficult time to come, just to make sense of it all.
Mm-hmm.
It was crazy. I hadn't told my family at that point, and it took me about a year to tell my family. And in the end, I told them because I didn't want them to find out if they'd been called to my hospital bed
right.
when I was dying.
Right.
I thought that would be the worst possible time for them to find out
your bedside.
And by that time, I had known people whose families had found out that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And a very close friend of mine that I met at a newly diagnosed group, I became great friends with his mother, and she found out because he was dying, and he did die, and she was at his bedside, but she hadn't known anything about it before.
Right.
So I didn't want that to happen to my family. So it was really interesting because my dad wanted to know whether he could catch it from me, and then asked me if I was going to change my promiscuous lifestyle. And, you know, I'm not an angel. I'm not a born-again virgin.
I've had
lots of sex and I really enjoy it. Thank you very
exactly,
much.
Exactly.
But at the time, my life was like, I watched Coronation Street and EastEnders and I didn't go out because I was working really hard.
It wasn't the high and mighty life, was it?
No, but that just shows you what in the public's like. You know, my dad's a member of the public and that's how he perceived HIV, you know. So it was better then when people knew.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a bit about managing people then because, you know, while they get used to it, they're forever phoning you, asking if you're okay, sending you articles that they've read in the paper about new treatments. And again, thinking about that time when any glimmer of hope of a new medication was big news. But it sort of settled down. I talked about the newly diagnosed group. It was interesting because I got great support at Positively Women, but a lot of the women had families looking after children. They were in different circumstances than me. And I didn't have that in common with them. I had different issues because I was working and I was worried about work finding out and what my prospects were and all the rest of it. So I saw this group advertised and it was at the London Lighthouse, which was a very flashy building that everybody knew was an HIV place. And so I found out about this group, and the first week I just went and I stood outside the building. I didn't even go inside. And then the second week I went in, and they said the group was cancelled because the facilitator was off sick. But I persevered and went the next week. And it was so interesting because it was a group of guys and me. And when I went in the room, they thought I was the facilitator. And again, because they weren't used to seeing, you know, white women with HIV in those kind of settings. But it was a fantastic group because we were all going through the same journey at the same time, And my best friend now is still my best friend and is a member of our family now and has been to all our family events and weddings and things. Mm-hmm. Is a guy that I met at that group.
Right.
So in terms of the support I got, definitely the most support was from other people living with HIV and from all walks of life and all different people, and gay and straight, black, white, Asian.
Yeah,
you
it
know,
didn't matter.
The thing about HIV is it's a great leveller, if you like. You know, we join together and we meet each other, and it's the thing that we have in common at the first instance, but then we find we've got lots more in common.
Yeah.
That's humanity.
Yeah.
Human beings are human beings.
Yeah.
So I often say, for that reason, I wouldn't give it back, because of the most extraordinary people that I've met and have become my friends over the mm-hmm. years, and that I've learned so much from.
But you... So that was going to be my next question, actually, Babs. You're one of those people that are up there amongst the people that I always see doing stuff, or, you know, we've done things together, you know, that's very public things, talking about HIV. What got you to that point? You know, what was it that made you think, I want to use this in a positive way, you know?
In those early days... when I look back on it now, because we were dying,
mm-hmm.
we wanted things done quickly, and we wanted to fix things, we wanted to push on things, we wanted to get access to treatment, not only for us
here,
in the UK,
yeah,
but otherwise. For women, all the trials were on men.
Men, yeah.
You know, where if you looked at trial results and everything, and looking for somebody like you at that time, it was very difficult to find that.
Mm-hmm.
So there was so much work to be done, let alone the stigma and the things that we still talk about today. So, as I say, I had got involved with Positively Women. It was promoted to me as an organisation run by and for women. And in fact, that's how it started. It was started by three women who were living with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time I got involved... Yes, all the peer support workers were living with HIV, and I think a manager was, but higher up in the organisation, at CEO level and leadership team level and at the board level, it was not run by women living with HIV. And I didn't think that was right. And so I got myself elected onto the board as a service user rep, first of all. And I'd been working in the charitable sector, so the attitude was a bit disappointing. And not that that's nothing against Positively Women in particular, but I think in boards in general, there was the people with the lived experience and then the professionals,
mm-hmm.
and an attitude that, you know, to be a board member, you needed to be a certain type of person. And that it was the them and us almost.
Yes. Yeah.
And I wasn't advocating that we should just put loads of women living with HIV on the board just for the sake of it. What I was trying to get over to them is we should promote this opportunity, because we're missing out on getting the experience of women living with HIV who have other professional experience to bring as well as that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't about tokenism.
Yeah.
And for me, obviously, I'd been working in the charitable sector. I understood what charities were, and I felt I had things to offer, as well as from my previous career, which was in advertising and design.
Right.
So eventually then I did get to become a full board member. And then when the chair left, I was invited to be chair. And that was, I thought long and hard about that. It was quite a difficult decision for me, because I thought if I was going to be chair of that organisation, then I should be open and public about the fact that I'm living with HIV. I felt it would be hypocritical not to be in that role.
Yeah.
So I took on the role, and that's when I really started to be public about living with HIV. I was interviewed on TV. I did features in women's magazines, etc. And then the Daily Mail got in touch, and I did a feature for the Daily Mail. And I was quite worried about that and how they might write it. But actually, the journalist was really good, and it was a very good article. Mm-hmm. And the most funniest thing that people, my friends, made fun of me because it said something like "nice middle class girl."
And they
like
were
that.
Like, "Oh,
I certainly didn't start off as a middle class woman living with HIV." But I think one of the things about it was that I could do that as well. Mm-hmm. I'm very aware of my privilege of being a white woman and being a professional woman, that it was in a way easier for me to be public and speak about it because I wasn't in the asylum system.
Yeah.
I wasn't a black African woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
That could be then targeted with racist abuse. I did, of course, worry what the neighbours would think.
Yeah.
It was terrifying when I went to Tesco on the day that it came out, and there was my picture on the front page of the Daily Mail. But actually, it was fine for the most part. By that time, I was working as an emergency officer for a local authority. And when I knew this piece was going to be published and go, you know, I thought I needed to think about who to tell. And I told my union rep, and he came in the next day with his own cutlery and cup at his work. And he was really not very nice to me from that right. point on, which you think that of all people, that your union rep is supposed to be the most supportive.
Yeah, yeah. So to finish off, Babs, if the golden question, if you could give one piece of advice or say something to somebody that's just had their positive HIV diagnosis, what would it be?
I'd say, you know, when you're ready, don't be afraid to tell your friends and family. You don't have to go public and be in the Daily Mail or Women's Magazine.
Exactly,
you know, that's
yeah.
the extreme of it. But if there are people that you tell things about your life normally, mm-hmm. then tell them about this too.
Yeah.
Because although I've talked about some of the negative things that happened, I got the most amazing support from, I've had support from employers, from, you know, wider friends. It turned out that me being worried about neighbours, there was someone who lived in the flat above whose brother had HIV. Mm-hmm. So you can often internalise your own fear to an extent that it paralyses you.
Yeah.
And in life, we have to take some risk. And to me, it's a positive risk because you'll get more support than you will negative.
Okay, Babs, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been lovely getting to know more about your story. Yes, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Radio Reverb.
Radio Reverb.
Radio Reverb.
So welcome back to the HRVL, 97.2 FM and DAB+. Got a special guest today, Alan Spink, who is from the Sussex Beacon. How are you doing, Alan?
Hello, Josh. I'm fine, thanks.
Is that the right title for you at the Sussex Beacon?
I'm a specialist HIV caseworker at the Sussex Beacon. That's my job title.
Oh, fabulous. So, Alan, why are we here today?
Well, I'm here to talk to you about an upcoming workshop at Sussex Beacon called DQ for a Day, and that stands for Drag Queen for a Day.
Which just sounds amazing. So I'm going to be part of it, so I'm nervous, but I'm looking forward to it as well. How's it going so far?
We're ready. We're almost ready to go. It is very exciting. It's an idea I had last year, and it's taken a long time for it to actually happen, but it's happening next week. And we've got the money, we've got supplies, we've had amazing donations from lots of people within the community.
Yeah.
We've got some money from a drugs company. So we're ready to go.
All systems go.
I hope so.
Yeah. No, I'm really excited about it. I mean, why do you want to do it? Why is it important for these kind of projects?
It's very important to do workshops like this, particularly around self-stigma. There's still a lot of stigma around HIV, and a lot of work has been done by a lot of organisations regarding stigma. There's a lot of training going on. The THT run Positive Voices, talking to kids at school. Marlene Fisher Foundation has had two or three major campaigns, and almost every HIV organisation in the country has done what they can to attempt to address stigma. However, it doesn't matter if you eradicate stigma from the community altogether. If a person living with HIV is self-stigmatizing, yeah, it's not going to help them. So I think it's time for a major shift on how we approach stigma around HIV. And instead of focusing on the general population, let's focus on ourselves.
Yeah.
Let's see how we think about HIV and how we deal with HIV and how we perceive people might see us. And if we can show people who are experiencing self-stigma that there's an alternative way to be, then that can only be good.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I know from my own self-stigma that it really affects what I do, actually. I know I do things like this, which is stepping out of my comfort zone, but that self-stigma is just there all the time. I can, and these kind of things will help me to get more confidence.
I hope so. I've been living with HIV myself for 20 years, and probably for the first 10 years, I pretty much withdrew from society. Withdrew from anywhere where somebody might know me and know my status. I, for many years, wouldn't even go to the Lawson unit, but I've managed to conquer it for myself.
Yeah.
And now I'm always on the lookout for ways to help other people conquer it. But I would say that the push for this has come from my work at the Sussex Beacon.
Right.
As a specialist HIV caseworker, my remit is to visit people in their own homes right across Sussex. And I cover Hastings, Battle, Eastbourne, Crawley, East Grinstead, Worthing, Sompting, Littlehampton, Burgess Hill.
Everywhere, that's amazing.
Everywhere in Sussex. Yeah. And although, as we all know, in Brighton we've got the community HIV support service that medically support people in their homes, for people outside of Brighton and Hove there is very little support. And in East Sussex, there's pretty much none. It's just me travelling around in my little car.
And people must like that as well, having that face-to-face, that personal touch.
They do. Most do. However, one of the clearest examples of self-stigma is I have a client who I've been visiting for 3 years and I'm still not allowed in his house.
Right.
He has this idea in his head that if I rock up, his neighbourhood will know that he's living with HIV. Initially, he thought I would drive a car with the Sussex Beacon emblazoned all over it, you know, on my way to visit someone with HIV, flashing light on the top. And I sort of convinced him it wasn't that. Then he thought I'd be in a uniform and maybe a something. But he just always thought that if I turned up at his house, his neighbours would know. And I don't think there's a clearer example of self-stigma than that.
That's like extreme, isn't it? And that's kind of unbelievable, yeah. And that needs to be worked. That needs to be looked at and sort of supported.
It really does. Yeah. And it's not just a few people like that. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Within Brighton, things are slightly different because there's, 2,500 of us or so. And probably, at the moment, I'm going to say maybe, I'm guessing 10% of people have issues. We have issues with our HIV. But the percentage of people struggling with HIV further afield is much higher.
Yeah.
So I want to do what I can to help people.
That's brilliant. Really good. So the workshop is, what's the workshop? You have 3 days.
The idea sprang from a couple of things I saw last year. One was a TV show called Drag SOS with the amazing Cheddar Gorgeous taking part, where these drag queens went in like an ice cream van visiting little towns around England, deprived areas, really, looking for people whose lives had paused for one reason or another. And they helped them through the course of a week about drag, talking about their issues, of developing a new persona and kick-starting their lives. And the other was I attended the big Brighton drag pageant, difficult to say, at the Fringe Festival last year. And I was just not only bowled away by the range of talent on display, people that I'd never heard of, and you see this amazing drag scene in Brighton, but many of them, when they were talking about who they were, talked about how drag had helped them with their mental health. And after those two things, I sort of started thinking about it. I thought, well, maybe we could do something like this for people living with HIV. Because for many of us that self-stigmatise, we develop a mask that we wear. And that mask is very thick and very heavy, but nobody can get through it. Yeah. Self-defense, but it is heavy. And for some of us, it means we stop developing as people, our lives stop, our careers stop. Mm. Everything just stops while we concentrate on this mask that's defending us, but it becomes like a prison.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's swap one mask for another.
Absolutely.
That's the idea.
I'm waiting to drop my mask.
I can't wait to see your mask melt away, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what mask is going to appear underneath.
Yes. My mask comes out a lot when I'm at home, but on my own. But it's nice to being around in that social environment.
Yeah.
It changes you, doesn't it? And you can, for me, I'll go into my shell. So when I'm out, I don't want people to see that other side of me. So
I think that's a fairly common thing, yeah. Particularly living with HIV,
yeah.
Where we often feel that we're going to be judged because we're living with this virus, and self-stigma merges with a lack of self-confidence,
yeah.
And that turns into social anxiety, and we end up not going out. We end up staying at home.
Yeah.
But there's another reason as well that I want to do this, and that's related to aging with HIV. Because as we grow older, mm-hmm. as a cohort, and we are, the average age is rising quickly, it's really important that we approach our old age with a level of confidence that's going to allow us to grow old and deal with medics, with doctors, with nurses, with hospitals, and eventually with care homes.
Yeah.
And the last thing I want is to see somebody, even myself, end up going into a care home and becoming stigmatised again for living with HIV. I think it's already a problem for elder gay people who want to go into a nursing home. Finding a nursing home that will allow you to live in dignity as an LGBT person is one thing, and that's hard enough. And I just can't imagine how we're going to manage that at the moment if you throw HIV into the mix. So part of this is like empowering people,
yeah.
to get the treatment that they deserve.
Yeah, and that's a great cause. So we'll have you back on when we've done the workshops and okay. See how it went. That'd be
excellent.
Great.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And thank you for coming on, and good luck for it at the weekend.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks. Thank you very much. So we've got some community news now, haven't
we? We have, yes.
So this week is really important because on Saturday the 18th is the well-awaited Fighting HIV Stigma March in London. So what are you thinking about that? Are you thinking of going, David?
I think I'd love to go. I think it's really important to be visible living with HIV in order to combat stigma. And I think it's a great opportunity to be assembled in number and just to show that we're not scared of HIV, and nobody else should be either.
Yeah, so I'll just go over the details with everyone. Mm. So there's about 30 plus groups and charities which is going to march, which is amazing, really,
yeah.
Isn't it? And the march starts at noon at Forum Magnum Square, which is southeast London, which I'm not sure. Do you know where that is? I don't know.
Google it.
You can just Google it, yeah, that's where. And then the march goes on to Trafalgar Square, and hopefully they're going to get there about 2 p.m. I think there's lots of speakers on there. I don't know who's... There's a list of speakers, but we haven't got that down there. Everyone's welcome. They're expecting thousands to stand in solidarity. And the HIV has changed so far, but I think stigma hasn't, what do you think, David? Mm. Yeah,
so go along. So that's noon on Saturday at the Forum Magnum Square in London. I think it's just north of the Thames.
Yeah. I'm kind of on my own whether to go. I want to go, and I was kind of thinking I'm trying to get people to come. So maybe we could go.
It'd be great if we go and we'd interview people along the way as well, couldn't we? And
get some vox pops, learn
some more journeys and stories. Yeah.
So if you see us running up to you with a magnet,
yeah, come and say hello to us. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what's next?
Finally, after many years in construction, the Lawson unit, which is the HIV clinic in Brighton, is moving to new premises in a brand new swanky hospital. It'll be on the sixth floor with beautiful views across Brighton and the seafront, looking out towards the sea. The move is expected to happen around the 14th of April, and we'll actually be interviewing some staff from the Lawson unit once they've actually moved in, and to explain the wonderful new premises. Because I mean, the Lawson unit has evolved over time. I mean, it was one of the first HIV outpatients units going that I'm aware of, and was started from what was like a tiny little broom cupboard, and has sort of slowly got bigger and bigger, and it's dispersing at the seams now with in a building that's not appropriate for its current function. So moving to new premises, it'll be great.
I've seen the images as well. Mm. It looks amazing up there, actually. Mm. Isn't it? Very yeah. clean. And you can see for miles out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you going to do a video or something? Are you,
I think, yes, I think we are, yeah. Yeah.
On our Facebook page or something.
Yeah, yeah. So we got. I think when we've got a member of staff, who's actually going to take us round the clinic once they've moved in and actually show us the treatment rooms and the different and the you know the new reception and the wonderful views.
But I think some if because you know I mean you've been going to a place which is actually on its own, so it's got its own entrance. People might be feeling a bit apprehensive about it. So if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can always contact the Lawson unit. But if you go to the brightonsexualhealth.com and go to the clinic's Lawson unit page, and you've got there's lots of information on there, isn't there, David?
Yes, yeah. And if you are a patient in Brighton and are wondering, you know, when to stop going to the current site, please be rest assured that, that the Lawson unit will be contacting all patients when the move is definitely finalised, and you know you'll know when not to go to the old clinic and when to start going to the new clinic.
It's around April, is it April the 14th?
April the 14th is the planned date, but of course things may change. We may get a hurricane suddenly blow through and who knows?
Yes, you never know what these things do. It kind of changes.
If the universe is willing, it'll be the 14th of April.
Yes. So next one for me is, there's another, oh, it's the last one actually, the Terence Higgins Trust. It's the monkeypox walk-in vaccinations. And that's taking place on Monday the 27th of March and 4 till 7pm. And that's going to be at the THT offices in Brighton, 61 Ship Street. BN1 1A. So if you want some more information, go to their website, tht.org.uk/mpox. Again, there's no appointment necessary, so you just walk in, but it's the last one they're doing at Terence Higgins Trust.
Mm-hmm. And listeners may remember that a few weeks ago we interviewed Gary Pargeter from Lunch Positive, and I'd just like to remind you all that Lunch Positive holds its Friday Lunch Club every Friday from 12 noon till 2pm at Dorset Gardens Methodist Church, Brighton. And it's not just the Friday Lunch Club that they do. They also do a supper club once a month for over 50s of an evening. They also have a befriending service, and they also have they're starting to do events in other towns because not everything survives. You know, Brighton isn't the centre of the universe, however may we think so. You know, we are right in the very centre of it here. But yeah, so Eastbourne and other towns. So check out lunchpositive.org's website, lunchpositive.org.
They're doing quite well, aren't they? With the different towns.
I mean, they really have strengthened community bonds, and people have made a lot of friendships and found a lot of support through Lunch Positive. So well done then.
Yeah, great. And just to mention Sussex Beacon, if you're interested in or you need support from them and inquiries, go to their website, which is sussexbeacon.org.uk. That's right, isn't it, David?
Yes, it is indeed. Yeah.
Sure. So you can also email them info@sussexbeacon.org. Or is that info@sussexbeacon.org.uk? Is the website?
Yes, that's the email address. Yeah, right, yes. So the website is sussexbeacon.org.uk. And for the people that don't know what Sussex Beacon is, it is a care centre for people living with HIV. It has a 10-bedded inpatient unit, and it also runs day services and exercise classes, mindfulness courses, all for people living with HIV. So please do check out their website. A lot of their services you can self-refer to. Obviously, the inpatient unit, you have to be referred by a medical practitioner.
It's so essential, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very essential. Yeah, so great. That's brilliant. That's community news.
Oh my god, that was quick. Yeah, what an amazing show, and great to have a great female list of people that we've interviewed today. Because obviously we just had
International
Women's Day.
Yes,
lovely to speak to Tamsin in person, and fascinating to hear Bab's life story and journey.
And yeah, so have you got it? Oh, it might be the march. So Matsy on the march.
Yes.
What are you going to wear if you go?
I don't know. I think I'm going to wrap up warm because it might be a bit chilly. But yeah.
Yeah, I can't really go in drag, can I? Because I'm all bit to next week.
You can if you want, but you have to go on the train. So.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I'll wait till I'll emerge next week.
Come, do your little chrysalis thing then later. You emerge as a beautiful butterfly.
Have you been talking?
I'm not saying that you're a maggot now. or caterpillar.
That's nice. Thanks. Anyway, I think it's time to go.
I think it is.
Viewers.
Goodbye, David.
Yes, you go, David. Get out. No, thank you for listening, everyone. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with the crew, I think.
HIVR is
is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.